Hey leaders, before we get into this episode, I wanted to tell you about a free event that I'm hosting, your Personal Leadership Audit Live Workshop. I've put the workshop together because if you want to stand out as an exceptional leader, you have to know yourself, inside and out. Understanding your strengths and weaknesses is critical, and for that, you need a high degree of self-awareness and a commitment to self-reflection. Now, if you're committed to unlocking your leadership potential, then working through a self-assessment like this is going to help you to quickly identify a path to higher impact. I'll be leading you through a deep dive into the 7 imperatives of my No Bullshit Leadership Framework, so that by the end of the session, you'll know exactly what areas you need to develop if you really want to stand out from the crowd. We're only opening up 150 spots, so register now at yourceomentor.com/workshop. That's yourceomentor.com/workshop. Are you selling a little or a lot? Either way, Shopify helps you do your thing. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. It helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. In fact, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And now you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Most of the business owners who listen to No Bullshit Leadership want to go large. What's so cool about Shopify is that no matter how big you want to grow, it gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/leadership, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/leadership now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/leadership.
Hey leaders, Em here. We're finalizing Marty's 2024 speaking calendar and he still has a few opportunities available. Now you've experienced the impact that Marty has on the podcast, but that's only a tiny fraction of the impact that he has when he delivers an in-person keynote presentation. If you'd like to book Marty to speak at your organization's event, go to martingmore.com or send us an email at hello@martingmore.com and we can chat about how to tailor his powerful message to your leaders to achieve real results. All right, now back to the episode.
Welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast. In a world where knowledge has become a commodity, this podcast is designed to give you something more. Access to the experience of a successful CEO who has already walked the path. So join your host, Martin Moore, who will unlock and bring to life your own leadership experiences and accelerate your journey to leadership excellence.
Hey there, and welcome to episode 295 of the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast. This week's episode, my biggest executive level mistakes and how I turned them into strengths. We posted a brief piece on social media recently outlining the 3 biggest mistakes I made as I was finding my feet in my early senior leadership roles. To say that the post went viral is an understatement. The response to social media can be the most useful feedback we receive because it's a reasonably accurate reflection of the topics that are resonating with you the most. Given that you've sent us such a strong message about this particular subject, we've decided to slot in today's episode to go a little deeper on these 3 critical areas of performance. Now, the good news is that once I was aware of them, I was able to put some strategies in place to fill the holes, and this had the surprising outcome of turning them into strengths. They became part of the rock-solid foundations in my leadership repertoire, and for at least one of the weaknesses, it became an unqualified strength, which gave me a competitive edge over my peers. In today's episode, I'm going to take a closer look at the 3 biggest mistakes I was making when I stepped into more senior level roles and how I managed to turn these into strengths. I'd love you to be able to do the same without having to get quite as many scars as I did. So, let's get into it. The first mistake that really hurt me when I was new to the ranks of senior leadership, was not reading the political play. Now, I thought that just delivering superior results would overshadow everything else, as long as it was done ethically and didn't go outside the company's risk envelope. Well, apparently not. I was blindsided several times by political attacks from peers that I didn't see coming, and they cost me and my team dearly. We were able to recover, but it took a huge amount of energy on my part to undo the damage. And look, even when I did, I think there were some residual question marks that we couldn't erase. Despite all the talk about collaboration, life at the upper echelons of most businesses is incredibly competitive. Executives vying for favour with the CEO and the board, all hoping that they'll be the next anointed one. Many behave more like politicians than they do business people. They evaluate their own performance, not based on the results they achieve for the company, but how much favour they carry with the power brokers at the top. And look, it's easy to fall into this trap. I've seen many otherwise capable executives do so. But this is when you have to ask yourself a few important questions. What type of leader do I want to be? How do I want my contribution to be remembered? And when people say nice things at my farewell, will they be heartfelt and genuine, or will they have to lie through their teeth for the sake of protocol? And when it comes to politics, the tone is set by the group executive. The leader sets the tone. I think of this as a behavioural continuum. On one end, you have the behaviour of self-seeking ego politics. And on the other, you have selfless pursuit of the best outcomes you can possibly deliver for the business. Very few people are at either extreme, but everyone falls somewhere on this continuum. I decided that for me, I wanted to be as close to the selfless end as I possibly could. Why? Because I highly value my self-respect. And from what I can tell, unless you're a sociopath, it's hard to maintain your self-respect when you know deep down that you're a manipulative liar. But I also know that some people will just choose to believe their own bullshit, and that's going to keep the conscience squared away for the most part. Political animals behave the way they do for all sorts of reasons, but I just want to share a couple of the most vivid examples that come to mind for me. One woman, who I'll call Jane, must have realised in the early part of her career that she wasn't as smart as the average bear. But she was still incredibly ambitious. So she worked out that the best use of her skills would be to learn how to mould, manipulate, and satisfy her boss. Very chameleon-like. She was driven purely by what made her boss happy, and she would carry out his desires without question. Problem was, when she detected a threat from someone else who was receiving positive attention from that boss, her insecurity would force her to undermine that person. And although that's really obvious and very freaking ugly, Jane managed to get away with it. She also did the dirty jobs for the CEO, which further ingratiated her in his eyes. Another woman, who I'll just call Greta, was really just a self-righteous yes person. Her deal was simply to protect her relationship with the CEO by being as fawning and obsequious as she could possibly be. Whenever I had to watch her hanging on his every word in an executive meeting, I got to tell you, I used to throw up in my mouth a little bit. So, when I challenged her assessment of one of her people in a talent management discussion, she took great exception to it and decided to exact revenge. She could not stand the fact that I'd called bullshit on her in an executive meeting, so she set about to covertly destroy my reputation. And to give her her due, she did a pretty good job. It wasn't until a loyal HR business partner confided in me about what she was doing and why that I woke up to what was going on. And after those experiences, I realised just how naive I had actually been. I developed a three-pronged approach to being more aware of politics. But fortunately, because I had such an aversion to it and such a distaste for political players, I was able to do it without sinking to their level. The first thing I did was to create cross-business unit alliances. Now, nothing is really achieved these days in companies of any size without some form of cross-team collaboration. So I made sure I developed strong alliances with the people who I knew were relying on me to deliver for them. And in turn, this created incredible loyalty. In the rooms that I wasn't in, I believe I had people with significant influence protecting my interests and speaking on my behalf. The second thing I did was to have direct conversations with the rumour mongers. Now, on the occasions where I had reasonable intel on what was being said behind my back, I would confront the individual directly. Before that realisation, I used to think it was best to take the British monarchy approach of never complain, never explain. But I learned that there were times when I'd be better off going head to head. So I'd just drop into their office casually and say something like this. "Hey Greta, I've heard along the grapevine that you've been saying X about me and my team. I just want you to know, in case you don't already, that it's not true. Now, I wouldn't embarrass you by sharing this with the CEO, but I'd just appreciate it if you come to me directly next time when you hear something like that." Believe it or not, this can be quite effective to put a shot over the bow. If nothing else, they know after a conversation like that that you won't be inclined to take any shit from them. And that normally slows them down just a little. The third thing I did was that I got into the habit of letting the CEO know my position. I'd be careful not to let the conversation descend into a he said, she said, but I'd be pretty clear that I knew what was going on, that I wasn't interested in playing the political game, and that I would deal with it myself. In other words, "Hey look boss, I don't want you to do anything, but I also don't want you going off half-cocked and believing this idiot." So my dialogue would go something like this. "Look, I know Greta is trying to undermine me, and no doubt you've heard plenty of rumours. I don't want you to intervene, I can fight my own battles. But I just wanted to let you know that I don't play games, so I'm just going to continue to focus on producing results. So if you're ever wondering where I am, I'll be off working with my team on how to deliver the most value for the company." My second big mistake when I was new to the ranks of senior leadership was being too slow to deal with poor performers. I used to give people a really long time to hit the standard of performance I was expecting. Now, doing this when you're at the lower levels isn't such a big deal. But the higher up you go, the greater the impact your direct reports can have. And at this altitude, leaving a poor performing leader in place can risk the performance of the whole company. Early on, when these leaders clearly weren't hitting the mark, I would give them the benefit of the doubt. And for me, this wasn't driven by the things that cause most leaders to hesitate or avoid performance issues. It wasn't about me being afraid of conflict or even about feeling sorry for the individuals involved. I certainly wasn't squeamish about difficult conversations, and I can't even tell you how many people I'd terminated for underperformance up to that point in my career. My lack of speed was driven by two things, which were subtly different. The first was my overdeveloped sense of fairness and equity. I found myself giving people more time than was reasonable to demonstrate acceptable performance. And the second reason was that I knew the pain of having to start again after investing a lot of time, energy, and money into getting a direct report to the current level of performance, even if it was still substandard. I was a slave to sunk cost. Now, the bottom line is that I kept several poorly performing leaders in their roles far longer than I should have. Once I realised this, I shifted my tactics to move way faster. I got much more diligent in the first weeks and months of a new leader's tenure. I would scrutinise their work much more closely. I would start the informal correction and calibration process much sooner. I would expect the best, but prepare for the worst, so that I could nip any performance issues in the bud one way or another. And I would spend more time with the people below them to get some much-needed insight into what that leader looked like from below. I asked them fairly innocuous questions, but they were super useful. What messages is Peter giving you? What do you think is most important to the company right now? Where are you focusing your energies? Are you really clear on what Peter wants you to do? If you aren't diligent about doing that calibration work, so in other words, looking at individual performance from all angles, it's easy to be fooled by the rhetoric. As they say, Organizational structures are like a tree full of monkeys. When you're looking down from the top of the tree, all you can see is smiling faces. But if you're looking up from the bottom of the tree, all you can see is a bunch of assholes. So I learned to move quickly, diligently, and fairly on performance issues. And by the end of my career, I can say that I was at least 3 times faster than other executives at dealing with poor performers. But I also knew that despite that fact, I was still 30% slower than I could have been. My third big mistake when I was new to the ranks of senior leadership was giving people too much rope. This was a huge flaw in my execution armory. I would give people the trust and space to do their job, but I wasn't diligent enough in inspecting their outputs. I got into the nasty habit of trusting without verifying. I was too intent on two things. The first was not being a micromanager, and the second thing was giving my people 100% trust to do their job competently. Think about the dynamics here. When you've hired someone, they've just spent a considerable amount of time and energy during the hiring process to convince you that they have the skills, experience, and attitude to handle the role. So you feel as though they deserve the opportunity to show you what they can do. Unconstrained freedom to stamp their mark on the job was always my go-to for a new direct report. However, this led to surprises that I wasn't prepared for. Missed deadlines and off-track projects. So I had to think about how to do this better. I didn't want to not trust my people, but by the same token, I needed to manage the outcomes more diligently. So once again, I changed 3 things. The first was that I spent more time front-loading my expectations, what I was after specifically in terms of the outcomes. I set really clear expectations for quality, time, and value delivery. This process was an invaluable learning experience for me too. I would tune in really closely to how each person responded. And having honed my leadership craft through thousands upon thousands of one-on-one conversations, I was pretty decent at reading people's reactions. The second was that, after making an assessment, I decided how frequent my touch points should be. How often did I need to check in, and how deep did my inquiry need to be? In my head, I was sliding up and down the scale of engagement styles based on situational leadership theory. Sure, I trust you, but based on my assessment of your capability and maturity, I'll take either a more or less interventionist approach. Now, ideally, I just love to leave them to it. But some people, especially if they're new to the company or industry, really needed short interval control. That is, frequent check-ins. The third thing was that I upped my level of diligence on single point accountability. I removed any uncertainty about who was accountable for which outcomes. This gave them the expectation that they needed to behave like corporate adults. It was a no blame, no excuses culture, which I know takes a little while for people to get comfortable with. But this was everything. It completely changed the energy of the individuals involved when they knew they were singularly accountable for the outcomes. I also realized that very few people will admit to being in trouble. They'll try to fix it, or sometimes they'll just hope it's going to get better. And when it doesn't, they rely on excuses. But with these 3 changes, I managed to circumvent the vicious circle of the unpredictability of the outcomes. I gave everyone the trust and autonomy to do their job, but I didn't just take their word for it. I worked out how to be more diligent at inspecting progress while still trusting them and not micromanaging them. So instead of hearing them tell me how they were going and me saying, "That's awesome," I learned to say, "That's awesome. Show me what you mean." Making the mistakes was one thing, but learning how to fix them was a revelation. Combining some of these skills enabled me to put together my model for execution excellence, balancing accountability and empowerment in just the right measure. And at the end of the day, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. This underpinned the stunning results that my teams were able to achieve in my last few executive roles, and it later went on to form the basis for my No Bullshit Leadership framework. We all make mistakes at each new level that we move to in our career, It's an essential part of our growth and development. But the higher up you go, the bigger the impact that those mistakes have. I was really lucky. I learned how to cover my three biggest gaps before I found myself in a large CEO role where those mistakes would have been really costly. It was these learnings, which really only came to me after the age of 45, that enabled me to excel as a business executive and leader. So if you're still young and working your way up, it's unlikely you've even discovered your biggest challenges yet. But don't worry, keep learning and keep growing. And when your biggest challenges come for you, you'll work out how to deal with them, just as I did. And that will make you unstoppable. All right, so that brings us to the end of episode 295. Thanks so much for joining us. And remember, at Your CEO Mentor, our purpose is to improve the quality of leaders globally. So please make sure you share this episode with a leader you know who's on the fast track to senior leadership levels. I look forward to next week's episode, The Middle Manager Makes a Comeback. Until then, I know you'll take every opportunity you can to be a no-bullshit leader.